Welcome to the Ecosystem Services Market Consortium podcast, episode number 2. I bet you're wondering who ESMC is and what they do. I bet you're wondering why you should take time to listen to this podcast. Here is why. With carbon and environmental credits being a hot topic right now, there is a huge financial potential for agriculture. In this series of podcasts, you will learn how and why. I'm Lori Boyer, your host, and I'm joined by Debbie Reed, ESMC Executive Director, and today we will cover agriculture's potential to not only reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also store carbon and how this benefits offset markets. Debbie, as we pick up here on our second podcast talking about carbon market developments and carbon market offsets, and agriculture's role in that. We'll specifically focus here on agriculture for a while. And we wrapped up our show talking about the agriculture market and the potential, and it's a growing potential for agriculturalists. I know I've been in this field for about 25 years, and it's come up off and on, but I haven't known anybody who's really gotten into it, and I haven't had any real deep conversations on it. But as we continue to head to more renewable energy, and what the Biden administration wants to do with some of the changes in capturing carbon and being more mindful of the environment, agriculture gets to play a big role. And there's some good potential for them to benefit financially with them, right?
That's correct. And I think agriculture is an important solution set, if you will, for carbon markets for a variety of reasons. One, the world scientists have recently agreed and stated, and it's actually started in 2015, that increasing soil carbon, and including soil carbon in agricultural systems, is an important tool for how we reduce greenhouse gas emissions globally, and a cost-effective tool that has multiple benefits. I think the other thing is that agriculture is viewed as a sector that has a strong voluntary role to play. It's hard to cap emissions from agriculture, so we really need carrots, and markets are a carrot. And so a lot of other industries who need to reduce their own footprint, as well as the food and beverage sector, which needs to reduce its ag footprint, are interested in the role of agriculture. So there's high demand on agriculture right now. But third and perhaps most important is the fact that reduced greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture and improved soil carbon in agriculture tends to make the sector itself more resilient to climate change, right? So it's a nice closed loop example of a solution set that not only helps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and thus resolve climate change or solve climate change, but it improves the resilience of agriculture to some of the impacts we're seeing and makes it more productive. So increased soil carbon improves soil health, tilth, fertility, water holding capacity, reduces erosion to wind and water. So all of the things we're talking about are good for ag and good for others.
In our last discussion, we talked about how this is an intangible credit. It has some paperwork to follow. But I just recently did do an interview with a soil scientist. At least when we're talking about carbon in the ground, you've got some science, some actual dirt, if you will, that you can hold that proves that carbon storage that's in there, right?
That's exactly right. And we've actually been able to measure soil carbon through sampling in the ground for a long time, quite accurately and with great precision. The question is, how do you do that at scale cost effectively? Because to do that at scale, you have to take a lot of samples and a lot of resamples. So while we're sure we can measure it, the question is, how do we measure it at a scale that shows that we can generate a credit and sell it, but is not more costly than the cost of the credit, right? So that is really the sticky issue there, is cost versus benefits.
Is a carbon credit, and again, we're talking about the agriculture industry right now, is a carbon credit the same thing as a carbon bank? Is that two different terms or?
They are generally two different terms. A carbon credit itself represents 1 ton of carbon dioxide that has been reduced or removed from the atmosphere. And in carbon markets, if you follow the standards and you generate a credit according to the standards, all credits are fungible. So it doesn't matter where they come from because they meet the same underlying standards. And that's an important component to make carbon markets work globally, because, you know, as we discussed on the last podcast, globally, credits can be traded. But it is also, because they are intangible credit, you do have to have quite a paper trail to show that credit does exist. Yes.
Is there any way you can tell me, I'm just curious, like, what kind of dollar amount are we talking about for a carbon credit for agriculture? Can you just give me a ballpark figure?
In our last assessment, globally, the prices range between $3 and $20 per ton of carbon dioxide. They're starting to go up, and I think you will continue to see that go up as the demand increases. I would also add, I didn't ask your answer your question about the carbon bank, but a carbon bank itself, and I know this has been proposed by the Biden administration, my understanding of what was proposed as a carbon bank is a way to pay farmers in particular from a pot of money for greenhouse gas emission reductions. I don't think there has been a lot of clarity around what the Biden administration and USC in particular are looking at as a carbon bank. So I think it is meant to be separate from a carbon credit. I think it is meant to be a way to pay for a carbon credit from agriculture. But I think we're all waiting for more details.
Thank you for clarifying that. And we're talking both in terms of financial stuff, and then we're also talking in terms of actual production. And so the word bank, we have to be careful how we use it in our conversations, because for me anyway, I would get real confused if I'm not careful how I'm asking you these questions. If we're talking about a financial institution or we're talking about some non-tangible type thing, because that's what carbon credits are at this point.
Yes, that's correct. So I think we're all waiting for clarity on that. And you're right. Environmental markets, there are banks that have been set up. Mm. For instance, wetland banks were one of the first successful environmental markets in which credits were banked that could then be utilized and tapped from buyers, right? So the bank itself could, in fact, be a bank of credits that are available to buyers. That's one interpretation of what a carbon bank might be.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that as well. Good clarification, but it just adds to that whole mix of how we use the word bank.
That's right. Yes.
You mentioned these can be done global. One of my questions is going to be, you know, will there be more credits available for areas of the country where there's more farming or not? So for example, if there's a lot more farmers in Iowa than in Colorado, will there be more credits available in that area? But it doesn't sound like that. Am I interpreting that right?
It's likely that if you have an area with a lot more farmers than another area, you can generate more credits from that area. However, they can basically be bought and sold anywhere in a carbon offset market. However, there are certain agricultural activities that can generate more credits than others, even on a per acre or per producer basis, for instance. And we alluded to this last time. So soil carbon, for instance, accumulates slowly and at about a half ton per acre per year, generically across the United States. On the other hand, you could generate hundreds or even thousands of credits from a single farm if you're capturing methane, which is far more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon, or nitrous oxide, which is even more potent. So methane is about 30 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon, and nitrous oxide is about 300 times more potent. So 1 ton of methane, for instance, generates about 30 credits on a CO2e equivalent basis, right? How the credits are generated and from which greenhouse gas, particularly within agriculture, can really impact how many credits you can generate.
Boy, you know your stuff. Those facts and figures you just shared with me, that's incredible. For you just to roll that off, that really is mind-blowing on how a carbon credit is actually generated and how long it takes to generate that carbon credit.
With soil carbon in particular, right, it takes a while to accumulate. But with the others, they are permanent. The moment or the time that you don't generate methane or capture it and use it elsewhere, right, that becomes permanent right then and there. So there are differences, like there are temporal differences associated with those gases, as well as area, you know, geospatial differences, if you will.
Okay. So, we talked about the soil side of things, sampling and testing that way. But if we're talking about methane or even the nitrous, how is that measured as far as trying to figure out what a credit is and if it's working or if it's there?
So we know, I would say we know we have a much better handle on measuring nitrous oxide and methane. You can put chambers out on the landscape to measure nitrous oxide very accurately. That too is expensive. Models, which are process models, have evolved that can capture and estimate quite well how much either nitrous oxide is emitted or not emitted in your projects. We also model methane. And so there are different technologies. You generally in a market will not be measuring methane and nitrous oxide. You will be modeling it, right? Running a model that estimates how much emissions are reduced. So there are different technologies. But when you use the model, for instance, in the market, you have to have the data to show how accurate your model is and that you have in fact tested it. So there's that gets back to the paperwork we were discussing, given that these credits are so intact.
Debbie, I think it's pretty safe to say, in doing this for a long time, farmers really value their privacy and are a little hesitant when it comes to giving out details of names and locations of what they do. Is this all kept confidential, or does this data go like to government entities so they can track and so they can keep up to date with what's going on across the country with regard to the carbon credits?
Yeah. In the private voluntary markets that we work in, the data is not shared with the government. So that's an important thing. You know, data is often required to be shared if you're working in a government program, but these are not. So that's one important thing. I think the second thing is that producer privacy is obviously a very important issue here. So the market, and you have to really, the producers have to ask, what are your privacy policies and contracts, right? But producer privacy is very important. So for instance, in our system, we have very strict and robust producer privacy agreements, and we don't share producers' data even with buyers. We share the credits. These are the credits that have been generated by this producer, and you pay the producer, but we don't share confidential business information. We don't share the actual data behind the credits, but we do have to document that. And verifiers do have to look at that, right? But they have confidentiality agreements that they...
I just have one more question that I know of, and then I'll ask you to tell me if there's anything else I missed. As you were just now talking, we talked about the private ways to buy the carbon credits, kind of the, I call it traders, I guess, if you will. That for me, that makes sense. But you mentioned government. Do you foresee a possible government trade program coming down the pike as well?
I don't know. I think the issue there, there's several issues there, right? One of them is if in fact the government is doing that, then I'm not sure we're going to attract all of the producers we want to attract, right? Because of those data sharing issues, number one. Number two, I'm not sure you need government in these private voluntary markets, right? I think we like to tap government conservation programs, for instance, as a form of upfront finance that can help farmers pay for some of the practice changes. But we don't necessarily need a role for the federal government in these private voluntary markets. There may be roles for other parts of government, right, in monitoring the markets and how they operate. You know, certainly we see that with other agricultural and commodity markets, right? But I think that that role is, tends to be in terms of establishing standards for how things are traded, ensuring privacy and other issues like that, right? So I don't envision a role for the government in trading, certainly.
Anything else that I missed asking you or that you thought of as we were going along there to add to this one?
No, I don't think so.
Debbie Reed, Executive Director of the Ecosystem Market Services Consortium. I'm your host, Lori Boyer, and thank you for tuning in to the ESMC podcast today, the work of the Ecosystem Services Market Consortium, and further information is available on their website at ecosystemservicesmarket.org.